my Creative Chords series follows this exact premise where from the first page of the book, they are reading and improvising. So they learn, just as one quick example, they learn this the little silly tune, Hot Cross Buns, and boom, as soon as they can play that, here's some ideas to customize it. What would you like to do differently on measure three? So that they're just alongside. There isn't even a sense that they're two different activities. So as teachers sometimes say, I don't have time to teach improvisation. When would I do it? Would I do it every other lesson? Do I? How do I make time? Should it last 5 minutes? To me, there is not a separation. You come at the same music through both reading it and improvising with it. They go back and forth very handily.
Well, hi teachers. Welcome back to the Topcast. You're listening to Tim Topham here from Top Music. And this is episode number 214. Thank you so much for joining us. And a special shout out to all our Top Music Pro teachers out there. Hope everyone's going really, really well. And you're looking forward to today's episode. Now, today we're actually going to be digging back into the archives for one of our favorite episodes from way back in the first 100 episodes. And it's all about the topic which we are talking about, particularly this month inside Top Music Pro. And that's all about jazz, and particularly about the basics of giving our students the basics of jazz and just getting some fundamentals under our belt, enough that we can be confident getting students started. Now, most of us, and myself included, will never be phenomenal jazz musicians or jazz teachers because it is such a, it's like another whole language, isn't it? I mean, classical musicianship is one thing, theory is another thing, musicology is another one. Jazz is another whole language altogether. But there are some fundamentals and basics which we can all enjoy. And our special guest course creator for this month is the one and only Bradley Sawash. Now, he, as most of you will know, is a fantastic improviser and just an incredibly skilled jazz pianist. And he's inspired many piano teachers to bring more creativity into their piano teaching studios. And through this experience, he's found that there are about five myths of improvisation that tend to stop many classically trained pianists from getting started with jazz or improv, or indeed helping their students get started as well, because we really have to feel confident and comfortable in our own ability to do a little bit of improvising and understand chords and be able to lead a read sheet before we can pass that on to our students. And Bradley says that, you know, when we allow ourselves to believe these myths, we're closing ourselves off from our students to a whole section, another whole world, another language, as I said before, of music making. And the truth is that you probably do already improvise in some way, even if you maybe don't know it quite yet. Now, digging into the archives for today's episode was a huge amount of fun, and we've got a few more coming up over the December-January period, which I can't wait to share with you. But the reason we're focusing on jazz today is because we have just released a jazz course inside Top Music Pro. So for all our Evolution and Studio members and anyone that would like to join us, we now have a full comprehensive course about the basics of jazz from the one and only Bradley Sawash. You can see him at the piano, hear him improvise, and you will get all the skills that you need to be able to take a student who might have just been introduced or asked to join the jazz band at school from knowing very, very little to being at least comfortable and competent, and perhaps even then learning more and exploring improvising more themselves. Because the great thing is that as teachers, if we can just sow a little bit of a seed and give students a little bit of confidence, we never know quite where they're going to end up. So make sure if you don't already have a membership to Top Music Pro, come and join us, topmusicpro.com. Grab one of our studio memberships and you will get full access to this. It's our 34th comprehensive course that we've released, and it's an absolute doozy. You will not want to miss out at all. Today's show notes and full transcript are available at topmusic.co/episode214. So just before I bring Bradley in, here's a couple of things that you'll be learning today. We'll talk to Bradley about what improvisation actually means to him and some of the elements of jazz that are open to creativity. We will talk about improving your musical ear, why you don't have to be Oscar Peterson to improvise, the approach to creativity that Bradley advocates, and how to move to the next level with teaching more creativity in your lessons, and also why classically trained pianists shouldn't be scared of the uncertainty around improv. Let's get Bradley in and have a listen to our episode.
Please welcome the one and only Bradley Sawash. How are you going,
Happy
Bradley?
Happy to be here, Tim.
Okay, so before we get into it, We probably better define improvisation because we're going to be using it today. And I know there's some different ways to look at it. What's improvisation to you in the context of what we're talking about today?
Well, Tim, that's not a question I can answer shortly. I tend to think about that about half my day most days. So let me get at it from a couple of angles. Of course, improvisation can be so many things. It can be, I don't know if you can hear the piano, it can be free playing on, here's a, I don't know, a G chord. So I'm just playing some chords. That's one form of improvisation. Another is tiny little ornaments and embellishments that you add to a tune, not unlike what Baroque musicians were doing by putting little unwritten trills and things in, little changes to the melody. It is, but in the context that I teach it in, I teach it through a jazz lens. And so I'm going to define, instead of improvisation, I'm going to define jazz. So it's a very big word to try to define.
Good luck.
It's a huge bunch of styles. It almost is like saying classical, which of course encompasses a huge bunch of styles from 12th century Gregorian chant to, you know, yesterday's minimalism. But that's where you get into trouble when you think about it as a style. For me, jazz is not a style of music, and improvisation is not a style of music. They are approaches to making music. There's a big difference there because it's a way of music making. And here's what my definition of jazz is. I'll read it here. I've got it. Jazz is an approach to making music, not a style, that involves reading and improvising over specific rhythmic feels within a given harmonic context. Now, that's very academic, but let me break it down. Jazz involves reading and improvising. So that might already raise some eyebrows. There's this weird myth out there that jazz players and improvisers do everything by ear. I don't know of any professional improvising musicians who aren't excellent readers. So it's reading and improvising over a specific rhythmic feel. And all that means is, are we talking about, a swing feel? Are we talking about, somebody was talking about a tango the other day on a blues podcast I heard.
I don't know what that was.
So these are rhythmic contexts, jazz waltz. You know, they're stock feelings. They're things a drummer and a rhythm section relates to. So those are givens. The rhythmic feel is given. And the last given is the harmonic context, which is to say the chords are already there. So most of the time, improvisers have a lot that's already a nice foundation that they're bringing a little bit of personality and personalization to. And it's not so wide open as just play whatever you want. And that makes it a lot less scary. So I define it as an approach to making music.
Yeah, and let's face it, jazz musos, while they're learning the standards and the main tunes, they'll be using some kind of lead sheets generally. Eventually, they'll memorize a lot of it, I would imagine. But to get started, they have to be able to read, even if it is more of a lead sheet approach than a two-handed ballad that's all written out.
Right, right. Let me say one more thing about this, because I'm a jazz guy. I'm going to definitely pop some bubbles here with this. But last night we saw La La Land, which is about a jazz pianist, you know, and I related a lot to some of his misery he felt by not being able to play the music he loves. But I was not drawn to jazz, even though I've been a professional jazz musician for more than 30 years. I was not drawn to it by its sound or its history. That all came later. The thing that brought me to that music was it was the only place I could find a home for creativity. And after a while, I adapted it and learned it and studied the greats and all that. But it was just, I was desperate as a student to try to find a way to do my own thing. And rock and roll wasn't cutting it for me, playing block chords on an organ in bowling alleys. I did that for a while. It wasn't interesting. So as a guy with chops and deep musical interest, it was just the freest style I could find. And then over time, I adopted it. So I'm happy to improvise in any style that I can today. It's the improvisation, not the style, that grabs me.
Yeah, brilliant. All right. Well, that opened up a whole lot of can of worms I wasn't expecting, but that's good. That's good. It just shows that it is hard to closely define sometimes what we mean in piano teaching. Even the word lead sheet, even that, people might not know what that is or have a different idea about what that is. There's a number of terminology things that I think we could define better as musicians. But anyway, that's not the topic today.
Well, for example, quick one, chord chart and lead sheets, sometimes people use interchangeably, two different animals.
Well, so my understanding, a chord chart would be what you get from Ultimate Guitar or somewhere like that, which has got lyrics and just chords written above it, no musical notation. And a lead sheet has got a notated melody with chords above it. Is that your understanding?
Correct. Yes. But to confuse the issue more, if you go to a big band rehearsal and they hand you the lead sheets, they say, here are your charts. So it just mixes it all up.
All right. Well, look, I'm really keen to find out about your five myths of improvisation. So let's take it through. Start with number one.
All right. So number one, let me talk about these myths, just what they are. These are things that inhibit people from exploring improvisation. Myths, by definition, are kind of things that are assumed or kind of in our bones, but when we bring them out into the open air, sometimes they maybe don't hold up as well. So I hope to expose here a couple of things that are keeping people in a fixed mindset rather than a growth mindset. People thinking, I can't do this, and because I have unconsciously taken on these myths. So here's the first one. Myth number one is that you have to be born with a good ear. You either got it or you ain't. Okay, so there is, in my experience as a 30 plus years of improvisation, there is a bell curve of musicianship talent on the ear scale. And that bell curve has maybe 1% or 2% who are extremely gifted by playing with their ear and relying heavily on that, which means often absolute pitch, but not just that, but incredible memory to be able to copy the licks they hear. And that is somebody like Louis Armstrong is an extremely rare skill. On the other end is the 2% who are absolutely tin ears who can't count. And I do believe there are just certain very, very small percentage of people who can't seem to access their musicality. So outside of that, there's all the rest of us in this massive bell curve who can beat that myth down by study and practice. So the Mythbuster is that just like traditional music skills, playing by ear, personalizing melodies, and improvising, those skills are developed through study and practice. Hello, when you're good at something, it's because you work at it.
Yeah.
So. Right. Yeah.
The issue is, of course, that so many of us teachers weren't taught to practice our ears, if that makes sense. Unless we were going up for an audition or an exam or something like that, we would be run through the oral tests a couple of weeks before. But the rest of the time, we didn't often do that. And there wasn't that suggestion from our teachers to, go and see if you can pick this tune out by ear. So I have a feeling that's what has caused one of these myths, is people that just not being aware of it and experiencing it as a child.
And let me just say that improvising and playing by ear are different skills. I consider myself a very comfortable improviser and just an average play by ear guy. I go often to fiddle jam sessions. I love to play fiddle and mandolin. And I sit in a room with people who play these instruments entirely by ear, who cannot read a note. And it's astonishing. They say, let's learn a new tune today. They slow it down and play it 2-3 times on the recording with everybody's eyes closed. And the leader says, okay, you got it? Let's play. And I've managed to get the downbeats on most measures. And then they're saying, well, you're the jazz guy. You're great at this. And not so much, actually. Picking out a tune by ear is absolutely something that is separate. And it's absolutely something that gets better by doing it, which is one of the reasons I'd go to these jam sessions. So. Yeah. You want to hear the next myth?
Yeah. Let's do it.
Okay. And myth number two is that improvisation is too difficult, or it's too difficult for my students. So this myth arrives from comparing ourselves to the masters. Maybe your favorite pianist is Oscar Peterson, a brilliant virtuoso, regardless of style, just a technical monster. And you hear that and think, that's so difficult, or I just don't have those chops. But of course, someone like Oscar Peterson is one of the greatest musicians of all time. That's no comparison. Musicians improvise at all levels all the time. In fact, my Mythbuster is that anyone can improvise. And if you accept that Mythbuster, then there's a logical extension of that, which says by starting your students early, improvisation becomes a natural way to make music. In other words, it's just another lens in on a way to make music. Reading is half the deal, and improvising and playing by ear, those kinds of skills is half the deal.
Yeah.
So it doesn't need to be difficult. 100%
agree. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the earlier you start creating things with your students, the better. It becomes naturalized. I've got, I'm planning my my notebook beginners course and a webinar due to come out soon, which is all about that approach to just stay away from reading for a while. Get the ears turned on and exploring sounds. And I'm sure I know you don't teach many child beginners these days, but you would probably feel that that's a good thing to do too, right?
Right. And I mean, I've written beginner books. My Creative Chords series follows this exact premise where from the first page of the book, they are reading and improvising. So they learn, just as one quick example, they learn this the little silly tune, Hot Cross Buns, and boom, as soon as they can play that, here's some ideas to customize it. What would you like to do differently on measure three? So that they're just alongside. There isn't even a sense that they're two different activities. So as teachers sometimes say, I don't have time to teach improvisation. When would I do it? Would I do it every other lesson? How do I make time? Should it last 5 minutes? To me, there is not a separation. You come at the same music through both reading it and improvising with it. They go back and forth very handily.
Yeah, I'm very, very much in the same wavelength as you there. The more we pigeonhole all the activities of a piano lesson, the more we'll run out of time. You have to find the interconnectedness between these things. And that's why I love Paul Harris and his simultaneous learning approach from the UK. It should be a network. Theory connects with oral, connects with improvising, connects with reading. Everything's interlinked. And if we consider our music like that, we can do anything in a lesson.
Right. And when it's done right, the student understands the reasons for things then.
Yeah.
Rather than running off and doing a theory notebook as a sort of unrelated side activity, which doesn't relate to anything else.
Absolutely.
So on to myth three.
Yeah, let's do it.
It's the previous myth was about it being too difficult. I'm referring to technical difficulty. But this myth has to do with the music theory. The myth is you have to be a music theory genius to teach creativity or to play improvisation or to be a personalizing artist. Personalizing meaning bring your own notes, not just dynamics and phrasing, but you bring your own notes to other people's music. And the reason that this myth exists is because many people, especially classically trained pianists, have a pretty substantial library of improvisation books because they're naturally curious about this. And typically those books are just too darn hard. They start on page one and say, here are eight jazz scales, including the bebop dominant and the Locrian, and they say, try using these scales on the next tune. And immediately you're like, what is this? It's so deep and heavy. And a lot of that has to do with the history of how jazz was first turned into an educational subject. A lot of it went on in North Texas State University and Indiana University by a guy named David Baker and Jerry Coker and some of these legends of the beginning of jazz education. And they were teaching at the college level. So it didn't start in the home studio. And so they were coming in with students that already knew a whole lot. And that's where their chapter one was based on that. Fortunately, over this past several years, there's been more authors who are realizing that there's ways to teach this a lot earlier. So my myth buster that it's too much music theory is this. If you can teach a major scale and a few chords, you have the skills you need to begin teaching improvisation. And let me just make a comment on that. There are some ways into improvisation which allow the student to experience improvisation. And one of the people who's so good at that is Forrest Kinney with his pattern play books, that where the teacher can play a pre-written part and then the student can experience improvisation by sticking to certain keys, such as the black keys and so on. And that's a great door opener, and everybody should explore that. But when I'm talking about improvisation and music theory, I'm talking about the next step where there's understanding of what you're playing, where the student says, this is an E flat minor chord, and these are the notes in it, and these are the notes that will fit with it. So that's a little bit further down the road when we've experienced it, but now we're ready to do our own music making. And I think those are very complementary approaches.
Yeah, it's great when students start making that connection between the theory of chord progressions, chords, and scales. When they start making that move, they really take big leaps in their playing, I feel, and improvising. But as you say, to start with what works, and the pattern play series is great for that. It's going to ask something else. I can't remember what it was at the moment, but it'll come back to me.
Well, I can plow ahead to myth number four if you like.
Let's do it.
Okay, myth number four, and this is kind of hard to explain, but here it is. Like reading music, the myth is that improvisers always know exactly what they will be playing next. In other words, if you're classically trained, you like the feeling of feeling prepared. You're used to knowing where your pitfalls are, have ironed them out. You know what's going to happen. You've even practiced your page turns. There's a lot of givens. And when you encounter improvisation, then it feels like a vacuum. There's no preparedness. And whereas improvisers relish the lack of preparedness, in a sense, they relish being in the moment, not knowing what's going to come next is part of the thrill of it. So when a classical musician begins to improvise, it feels like they're walking on jello because they don't know what's happening and what's coming next. They don't know what they're going to play next, and that's disconcerting. They think, gee, a real improviser must know exactly what they're going to play. But that's not right. The actual myth is that even for skilled improvisers, it can still feel like stumbling around in the dark. So when I play my concerts and I'm looking up passionately with my eyes closed in an apparent moment of ecstasy, I may just as well be praying for an idea. So yeah, I think on a great night, if I'm playing to the top of my game, about 75% of my notes are what I'd hope to play, what I'm trying to hear and get out. And the other 25% are relying on knowledge and guesswork and hopes and dreams to just hopefully that it comes out musically.
Hearing that come from someone who I've heard perform and been blown away by is really heartening, I think, for us who are just starting our improvisation journeys, to hear you say that 75% is kind of what you wanted. And that's when you're on the top of your game. So I imagine there's plenty that you might be a 50-50. To know that someone like you feels that way, I think is really, really, really good for us.
Thank you. Another piece of that is that sometimes skilled improvisers get just run on playing. I know what notes will work. So when I'm not at the top of my game, I am just wandering around. And one of the things that I'm constantly saying to myself when I'm improvising, especially in front of listeners, is, Bradley, are you meaning what you play? Are you saying something? Are you making a statement? Are you clear about your intent? Or are you just wiggling your fingers on notes that you know will work? So it's kind of the same thing. It's a little bit related, but I'm trying to, just like in this podcast, I'm trying to not just stammer around and talk about anything that comes to mind, but try to keep point. It's kind of like that when you're improvising.
I find the most improvising that I do day to day, although it's not going to happen for the time being, was when I was in my head of keyboard role over the last 3 years. And my previous school, I would have to improvise at church, at services for my school, and just make stuff up when time needed to be filled. And that was my chance to improvise. And that wasn't jazz, obviously. That wouldn't be stylistically correct in that location. And so I would just doodle around on the keys, and I knew what would work, so I could always have a safe place to go. But I think the other thing I wanted to say is that sometimes when you improvise, it doesn't always work, and you're not going to necessarily be happy with what the outcome is. You might even have a bit of a fail, but that's okay. You know, you're trying, you're pushing your boundaries. You're, as you say, you don't know what's going to happen. Have you had any times when you've played and it's been actually been a bit of a failure?
Or just flat.
Yeah.
But this is where the theory, where knowing your theory, and by that I don't mean the deep theory, but just knowing, look, I'm in G major, and most of these chords are in this song are in G major, so I can sit down here and use the pentatonic scale and survive. You know, that's where you can get through a lack of inspiration by knowing what will at least work.
Yeah.
It's the other little piece of that, and this is a big deal, I don't want to get into this too much right now, but any note can be fixed. Any note can be made to sound good, and you get better and better at sort of sliding from an unintended note to a more to a better note,
yeah.
or turning, you know, turning it into an ornament. And that, as that skill grows, you feel more and more comfortable, like you're able to survive those moments.
I think it's great, but, too, if a student has the skill to work their ray around the chords in a key, then it is so much better if they have memory slips and they're playing something on a concert stage. And it's happened to me many times. I'm not the best memorizer, but if my memory fails, I can keep making sounds that are in the right key while I go, oh, what have I got to do? And then I'm back into it.
Okay, so I was playing the Bach three-part fugue. Is it three-part? The one that goes... That's the prelude.
C minor, and then
C minor. I was doing that in a jury in music school. And this was a sort of... This will be in the movie. I had one of those memory slips, and in the middle of a fugue, playing it without music. And it, you know, for those of you who haven't been to music school, a jury is where you have your back to four superior pianists who are your professors, all with notebooks with pencils. And every time you have the little slip, you hear the pencils scratching away.
Oh, it's the most, how awful!
Yeah, it's awful. Exactly. Oh. So I got lost. So I decided to. To sort of play in a Bach-ish way until I could recover. And I remembered where I was and then finished it out. So when I turned around, the head of the piano department, who's since passed on, put her glasses down on her nose and said, "How dare you do that to Bach?" And then my teacher said, "But I won't mention her name, but Ms., that is useful. Everybody has memory slips now and then to be able to recover. Is a nice skill." And she said, "I'm giving him lowest marks." He said, "Well, then I'm giving him highest marks." And the other two looked down, and I don't know what my final marks were, but I passed. So I don't know who was right. It would have been great not to have a memory slip, but it happened. So
I would have loved to have heard it, to be honest, but that's me.
Yeah.
All right, let's go to myth number five. I think we're up to
number five. Only jazz musicians can improvise, and only on certain instruments. Big myth. We think of improvisation, we think of jazz because that's one of the few styles that embraces it so openly. So we think maybe trumpet, saxophone, piano, bass, drums, things like that. But let's think about some of the great improvisers throughout history. Maybe you've heard of some of these guys, Beethoven, Brahms, Liszt, Mozart, Chopin, Bach. Chopin was such an improviser that he had a terrible time putting his music down in print. Because in concluding at least one story of running down to the publisher to change it, because he could always think of 10 more ways to play it. This is evident in his the flourishes you see in his writing, where they have 14 notes in one beat, you know, and then 12 on the next one. And he was constantly messing with it, and it was not comfortable for him to freeze it into ink because there were so many other ways to play it. But another really important improviser, and Tim, you just mentioned it, is everyone. Let's not kid ourselves. When if you're a pianist and the fan blows the music off your stand, you know, you're noodling around. Or if you're halfway through the wedding march and the bride hasn't quite made it to the altar yet and you can't play it, you know, you've played it twice and she's not there yet. Or the actress is off stage and having a little costume malfunction and can't get the zipper up on her dress and you're doing... Yeah, so we all improvise all the time because things go wrong and we have to cover it. So let's not kid ourselves and say we don't improvise. And I'll even go so far as to say that piano players improvise when they sight read. Give me a break. Of course you're not getting all those notes the first time through. We've figured out ways to call it scuffling, if you will. That's a form of improvisation. So the point is that everybody improvises in a lot of styles and a lot of settings, and we may as well embrace it and make a bigger deal out of it. And let me just name a few other styles that involve improvisation real quick. Bluegrass music is not set. Everybody steps forward and plays that solo. Let's think about something like Native American flute music, where they improvise on a certain scale of a love song, you know, to woo someone that's being courted. Or the Indian classical music, where there's a raga, which is a kind of detailed quarter tone scale, a raga for different times of the year and different religious holidays, but the music's not set. The sitar player works on what is only a set scale. So, you know, African music with kalimbas and thumb pianos, you know, improvising around some set notes and set rhythms. So it's just everywhere. And we hide our head in the sand when we think it's just jazz and, you know, rock guitar solos. I mean, it's just everywhere.
Yeah. And while teachers may not think they do it very often, I think sight reading, it's great that you brought that up because, you know, my sight reading is more improvising than just about anything, but it's the only way I've been able to get through. A massive part of my job over the last 6 years as a teacher at a college has been accompanying other instruments, and you don't have time to practice all that stuff. You've got to be a good sight reader, and to be a good sight reader, you look at the chord structure, you kind of fluff your way through it. And I've been
told
the
first thing I do is just as soon as I get handed that music, I start writing chord symbols in as a safety net.
Yeah, I do the same. And I've often been told, wow, you know, that was just amazing what you did. And I might have been playing at half what was written. And you know, it's great because it simplifies things and it makes it doable. But I really like that connection between improvisation and sight reading. You're absolutely right.
Right.
I wanted to, just before we start wrapping up, make a connection between improvising. I think it's easier to think about improvising a lot with the right hand. The right hand's moving all over the keys. Chopin's doing those massive runs. It all tends to be right hand. But what about the styles that are formed by left hand patterns? And you kind of did a demo at the start. That's a form of improvising too, right?
Yes. I mean, there's two things here. You can fill with your left hand. You know, let's see. Let's say we're playing Summertime. Which I know is not what you're talking about, but it's sometimes I try to think that if my left hand were a bassist and my right hand was a trumpet player, I want to make sure they both get to have some fun.
Yeah.
But that's what you're talking about is stock patterns. And this is a thing I love to teach and I'm big on, because if somebody says, I don't know, let's say I play Mary Had a Little Lamb here. And then someone says, oh, wow, you're so creative. It's just how, you know, how do you think like that? Well, 100% of what I just played, 100% of it was stock pattern stuff. And so knowing patterns makes it possible to accompany your students. It makes it possible to dress up a lead sheet or a little song. I'm not sure how you want me to get into this. I can show all kinds of patterns.
What's the just play the pattern without the melody that you just did then?
Yeah. So okay, that was a swing pattern. Maybe I'll just go through a few. And so a swing typically has a walking bass, and bass players are very inventive in the way they will manipulate the chord in their walking. But as a piano player, we can simplify all that and bring it down to a simple pattern. So a real go-to pattern among about, oh, five or six, that'll get you through 99% of the places you need to walk. A go-to pattern that almost always works is root, second, third, fifth. So on a C chord, C, D, E, G. Let's say I'm playing, you know, so Mary Little Lamb is a C chord without any dressing up the right hand, just. Okay, and what was the right hand doing? Just parallel structures. I'm grabbing a shape here. My shape has the E note on top, and that is the melody note, and then I have C, A, G underneath. So I have this sixth chord. I put those together and move that around, just move it around like my hand's in a cast. I don't have to, you know, just move that shape around. And taking in a careful listen, there's some wrong kind of notes in there. But in flight,
you get away with it.
It sounds terrific.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, there's one. There's
and so that would be a great go-to jazz walk swing pattern, right? What about you know, you did a little tango before, but what about like a rock? What if you wanted to rock out Mary Had a Little Lamb? What's your
okay?
What's
your that's lovely. So a lot of times especially teenage boys figure this out about do what I call rock octaves, where they're just C, 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 you know.
Oh, alternating.
Yeah.
Thumb and five. Yeah.
Boom, 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 boom with the pinky and the thumb. And that that will get you by through sort of a medium happy sound. But I could show you two more. One that's really cool is to put in the flat seven. So I'm going to play C to C. But on the way, I'm going to put a B flat in there. Now I'll just play chord notes with my right hand on a C chord. And do that on an F.
Okay. Cool. I haven't used that one before. Yeah, I like it.
Another one you can do is what I call a torch song, where the right hand plays just simple quarter note chords. Think of something like Let It Be. Right?
Yep.
Okay, and the left hand is going to play long notes with quick little notes connecting to the next root, if that makes sense. So say I'm going to go from a C to a G. Here's an F.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of a moving bass there.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that provides a nice background underneath the, you know, the student playing a melody or whatever.
So look, I mean, we could, this is a massive kind of area that we could touch on, and we don't have time today, and that's not really the topic, but I wanted to just mention it because I think this is one of those fundamental ways that teachers can get more creative with their students, is to explore these left-hand patterns and the effect that they have on the sound that a student is creating at the keyboard.
Right. Now, let me just say, you know, I have some like style glossaries and things that I pass out at my workshops and list some of these. And sometimes people treat them like they're a silver plate of gold or something. Here, you need to find stock patterns. And you say, what are these stock patterns? Oh, I need to know what they are. You're playing them all the time. If you're playing non-classical music and you, instead of just play it, if one looks at it with a thief's mind and says, what is going on in here? What is whoever it is, Dan Coates or some arranger, Philip Kevernan, you know, there's so many good arrangers out there of movie tunes and pop songs and things. When you get those piano folios, if you just go beyond just playing it and say, what's happening here? What can I borrow on my own? What is this pattern? Why do I like that? That's what I've spent a lifetime doing, both by listening to recordings and looking at music and think, oh, I like that. I'm going to use that. You don't have to make them all up. I mean, oh, what's that boogie pattern? Look in any boogie. There it is. Yeah. So I think you have to look like look at a piece of music as a grocery store where you can bring home some goodies and use them in your other pieces.
My plan in the next couple of weeks around this podcast is to create a bit of a stock pattern sheet like you've done, because I think while you can grab them out of music, it's also good to have a bit of a quick reference. And I like teaching myself, my students. I mean, one of the first patterns that every student should know is an Alberti bass that they can use, because that's going to come up and instantly you've got something that sounds classical.
Exactly.
And then you've got the pop root 5 octave, the standard thing that Dan Coates would do with every ballad and film piece. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think that there's definitely ways we can approach this with students. And I guess that kind of leads into how you can use lead sheets as well. So where you've got just the melody, chords above it, while you could play a triad in the left hand, it'll sound much more interesting if you give it a style with one of these stock patterns. So I think that's going to have to be the subject of a future discussion, though, Bradley. We're running out of time.
I'll look forward to that. There's always more to chat about with creativity.
Well, I hope you enjoyed today's look back at the archives. That was episode number 75, the 5 myths of improvisation with the one and only Bradley Sowash. As I mentioned, you must come and join us inside Top Music Pro membership. Bradley's course is unbelievable. Many of you have commented on the incredible course that the late Forrest Kinney created for us on lead sheets. And this one is set to rival it. It's just as creative and fun and engaging. And Bradley really has learnt experienced over the last 5 to 10 years of teaching teachers just how effectively just some simple tips and strategies, some demonstration can be for teachers that are a little bit unsure about taking the next step with jazz. And as we've said before too, if you have got students who are introduced to jazz bands at school and you're really stuck for how to read those lead sheets that the band gets given and what their role should be, then this is the course not to miss. Just head to topmusicpro.com and join us today. So I'm Tim Topham, and you've been listening to The Topcast from topmusic.co. Thank you so much for joining us, and I'll chat to you again soon. For more information about this episode and to find out how to enhance your own teaching, visit topmusic.co. You'll find everything you need for your studio, from lesson plans to cheat sheets, quick win teaching ideas, and guides on how to build your teaching business. Plus, you'll be connected to a global community of the world's top music teachers. And when you're ready, join hundreds of other teachers around the world by becoming a Top Music Pro member and get access to all our bonus content and flagship courses. And don't forget to follow topmusic.co on social media and subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to it. That's all for today. We'll see you in the studio.